Thank you to each of you for coming. This is a very exciting year to be talking about these topics. We have a lot of people here that are from various fields, and it just has the feel we were just talking beforehand of a time where if change is not afoot, the forces that will bring change certainly are afoot. So thanks to all of you for being part of that. I want to talk a little bit this morning about some of our efforts in the New York City jail system, working human rights into our correctional health apparatus. Before I do that, I wanted to say there are no disclosures other than that this is a conflicted and complex world, and as Bobby said, we should all acknowledge that. Oh, thanks. I also wanted to thank our colleagues from the WHO Health and Prisons Project, because this is work that is not routine in any correctional settings in the United States. We receive pushback, scrutiny, a raised eyebrow in many corners you might not expect when we do this work. And one of the things that has helped us is to say this is a standard in European settings. People acknowledge that the dual loyalties, the human rights concerns need to be addressed, and not addressing them simply means that you will let them get worse. That exists and is part of the discussion in Europe has helped us a great deal, so thank you. And please do report back to your colleagues and to everybody as part of this, is that's a tangible good of what you do, is to help us who are just starting in some of these endeavors. So thank you. So I'll talk a little bit about how we have tried to work human rights into our operations, our big health system, and then ask for some guidance maybe after all the other speakers have given their talks. New York City, it's a big jail system. I think in many other talks we've talked about it's large. It's the second largest in the United States. The bullet in here that is not our conventional talk is the third one there, which is that, you know, the second bullet, we always think about correctional health as this opportunity, right? We can do great public health, and we do, and we think it's good, and we pat ourselves on the back for it. The third one, though, is that we think that bad things happen to people when they're in jail and prison, and that part of the responsibility for correctional health systems is to assess, not just clean up the mess of when bad things happen to people, if they get injured or if they have a mental health exacerbation, but to quantify and risk stratify how the correctional setting confers risk to patients. Traditionally, we just talk about how people come in and they're sick, and if they're sick, maybe something bad happens, but it's probably a feature of their mental health problem or their other inherent individual problem. But really, part of the responsibility for correctional health, we believe, is to map out the ways in which the correctional health system confers new risks, real health risks, to the people that are placed in these settings. So we adopted a human rights framework. What that means is we made a Venn diagram. This is the first step for any health bureaucrat. And so the other, the two circles on there, patient safety and population health, are things that are pretty well known to many correctional health settings. You know, patient safety being, do you have policies and procedures that are good, that are consistent with community standards? The population health meaning, do you, use epidemiology and tools of epidemiology to track trends of different diseases, but what was missing was human rights, and we think that our case that we make is that human rights is an essential component in correctional health, and without it, you will fail in your mission to provide good care to your patients. So, sorry, I'll go back. When we talk about why we think human rights is important, we'll often get the question, why not talk about medical ethics? Because that's what health systems are used to, right? Keep in mind, we have a big health system. We have 1,400 people working in a health system just on the health side. We have all these patients, lots of money. So the core principles of medical ethics are important. We don't do them all very well, and so you could make a case that we should just focus on doing that. But there are some concepts beyond the traditional medical ethics concepts that we think are really important. Dual loyalty is one that we'll talk a little bit about. This notion that your mission as a health provider or a health system to care for the patient is eroded by the security setting. And that we'll talk a good bit more, because we've decided to start with that as a core concept we want to think about. So in operationalizing human rights in our setting, we decided to go with three levels of intervention. The high level was to come up with a place where we can have theoretical discussions with partners in the community, academics, experts, to talk about these big theoretical things like dual loyalty. Then we needed a mid-level, like an operational setting, where we could put these theoretical constructs into practice and design interventions, design studies, but do it in a way that fits with all the other stuff we do. Because remembering our Venn diagram, we want it to be part of the patient safety. We want it to be part of the population health. And then the most fine level detail is at the line level, how do we implement this with the individual staff members? So I'll go through an example or two to show you how we've tried this so far. So the high level, we created something called the Human Rights Collective. It's a meeting we have about every 3 months, and we take some big topic and bring in partners from the community, you know, academics, litigators, epidemiologists, human rights folks, to talk about something at a large level. Then the mid-level, we decided we would create a new component of our QI, Quality Improvement Committee, called the Human Rights Quality Improvement Committee. The QI committees are a feature of every health system in the United States. Even correctional health systems usually have a QI committee. So it's an apparatus that exists that is there to ensure the provision of good care and to detect when good care is not being delivered. And it, for us, it was a natural choice because it includes all the managers of jails from the nursing side, the medical side, patient relations, all the things that already exist. And then we'll get into what we did for staff training or kind of the line level intervention. So the Human Rights Collective, just to give you an example of the ones we've had so far, our first one was on intimate partner violence and incarceration. We had one on solitary, one on trafficking. We have one next week on traumatic brain injury and structural violence. So that's kind of the nature of the like big level topics we've picked for this. Now I'll show you how we walk this through the other, the mid-level and the line level. In the Human Rights Committee, the QI Committee, I'll talk a little bit about dual loyalty. So we had, coming out of the big picture Human Rights Collective, when we talked about solitary confinement, we learned a lot, talked a lot about dual loyalty, this problem I mentioned before. So we decided to make dual loyalty the first focus of our QI committee. And so this Quality Improvement Committee decided to first do an assessment of dual loyalty, look for dual loyalty around our correctional health setting, and then, based on where we find it, come up with an intervention. And this would be just the first of many, probably. So in our dual loyalty assessment, we looked at three types of data. First, we looked at patients who were housed in solitary confinement and looked at several thousand individual records to look for words and phrases that suggested dual loyalty, like things like malingering, goal-oriented. Then we looked at we had some focus groups with mental health staff to talk to them. And then we had some interviews with patients to ask them their perceptions of the care we deliver. What do they think about us as healthcare providers? So the findings speak for themselves. You know, assessing dual loyalty is a little bit like shooting fish in a barrel in a correctional health setting, right? You know it's there. Really what you're doing is going to content yourself that it's there and try and map out where you think it's the worst, which is not hard to predict, but we thought it's an important first step in this process. So then we decided we would come up with an online training about dual loyalty that we would have all of our providers, everybody, all 1,400 people go through and take. So just a little information about the training we did. We actually just rolled it out in the last 6 weeks. These are some of the bullets that people see when they log on. It's an anonymous survey. It's on SurveyMonkey. And so we have a little intro to what dual loyalty is. The third bullet I think is important because you're talking about it, people are going to think it's a bad thing and you're trying to get rid of it. And maybe you don't want to hear about it. And what we want to communicate is, it's a concern, but it's an omnipresent concern in correctional health, and we'll never get rid of it. The second you pick up a stethoscope or a blood pressure cuff, or you try and see a patient as a social worker, in a jail or prison, you encounter dual loyalty. So we don't want to say it doesn't exist or get rid of it. What we want to say is, it's there, we all feel it, let's figure out where it's worse, where it's better. And what can we do to mitigate what can happen, which is dual loyalty contributing to real human rights abuses? So we had about six scenarios that we walked people through in this training. This is just one of the six. All of them are from actual cases. I'll just let you look at it for a second. So then after we walk people through a scenario like that, we ask them questions. Have you ever encountered anything like this? How would you respond? And we give them some options. We also give them the opportunity to write for each of these questions, write in free text. In this case, we wanted to put it out there because it was, we thought the provider actually did a very inventive thing. They're in a cubicle, patient comes in, the patient says, the thing that's on that report that everybody wants me to sign, didn't. That's not what happened. But there's a correction officer there standing kind of in a threatening manner saying, nobody's going anywhere until that thing gets signed. But our provider, who was a new provider, you know, very cleverly thought, I'll put everything you're telling me into our EHR, which is just ours. Don't worry about this piece of paper. And then what she put in that EHR sent a flag to me to see the patient. Then we can go see the patient the next day, get a full account, report it to outside authorities. So, and then we have a discussion part of each of these scenarios. So that leads us into one of the other real key features of this human rights work is we have made major modifications to the electronic health record to make it what we think is the best human rights tool ever created. This is, it's hard to see some of this, but what we've done basically is take injury encounters, put in structured templates so that every time somebody's seen for any injury, clinicians have to click off different boxes that relate to intentionality, location, mechanism of injury, things that are important if we want to find and track abuse. And so the electronic health record for us has been and continues to be a key feature in how we keep a connection to the most vulnerable patients. So some of the other human rights activities besides what I just talked about, the Human Rights Collective, the QI Committee looking at the dual loyalty and then the training, we actually made modifications to the contract with all our vendors to say that they have to be part of human rights activities, which sounds silly, but we want everybody who interacts with us when they sign on the dotted line for financial considerations to know that this is something we mandate. And then I mentioned we have done a lot of modification of our electronic health record, and that is an ongoing process. But we really think that that is the best, one of the best tools for us to keep track of who's vulnerable and who we're worried about. So we think this is an important area. We think there's a lot more work to be done. But I think we would put in this third bullet, it's really important to think about, is there's a lot of sensitivity in the United States to talking about human rights, you know, in a setting where it's not popular. And so the thing we're learning is it may be, we think it's really important to talk about human rights with our providers to help them understand the problems that we all face. It may be that talking to other staff, like security staff, we might, I'm not sure if we use the same words or the same phrases, but it, we believe that it's important to integrate human rights. We haven't yet figured out the blurry lines between, like, where do we talk about human rights? Where do we talk about, like, disparities and health outcomes? Where do we talk about patient management? But we're thrilled, and we could use guidance from anybody who's here. So thank you all.
Thank you. Invite people in the back to sit down. There are lots of seats up front. You can leave when you need to. But please come sit down. Raphael will be our next. Sorry.
I have the, I think, benefit, actually, of going after Homer, who spoke about what was actually the title of my presentation. So I've been thinking a little bit. The title of what I'm speaking about, in addition to the title that's on the program, Witness to Dilemmas and Deformation, Observations on Health Professional Practice Inside a Women's Prison, my more informal title is called Divided Loyalties. So I'm going to be building on very much what you spoke about. I think the subject of divided loyalties is clear from Homer's presentation, which is really that people who go into the healthcare profession want to help people when they're inside of a context in which security prevails, dominance and dominates, may be placed in situations in which there's a conflict between being able to provide good medical care versus being able to be a good employee and follow the rules and regulations that are defined by security needs as defined by the system that they're in. This presentation is not about doctors or health personnel who are serving a system that has the evil desire to destroy people, such as people who were doctors or medical personnel that were involved in the gassing of people in Germany, or people that were involved in designing and overseeing waterboarding in Guantanamo and in other places. The presentation is also not about medical personnel who are clearly have perverse behavior and problems. When I was at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, where I served 22 years, my first experience with a gynecologist was one in which, when I lay down on the table, he fondled my breasts, commented on my breasts, and I learned subsequently that he was somebody who had that practice and more damage done to other people. Similarly, when I went to the dentist for the first time there, the dentist handed me a mirror that had a rubber penis at the end of it. Now, these are situations which are not unusual, I have to say, and this is not a presentation about people like that. This is a presentation about a health professional that wants to do good, but that is caught in a system in which security prevails. I'm going to give a couple of stories from, one story from Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, which was when I turned 50, I was told that I would get a colonoscopy. I had colon cancer in my family, and there was a security assessment that I was very, very high security. There was a desire not to take me out of the facility, but that was the only way to get a colonoscopy. And the level of security, the numbers of cars with guns sticking out of them that created a caravan on the road, security inside the hospital building with men in corridors with guns. It was not a good situation, but the colonoscopy occurred. But I think that the prison decided 5 years later that it was too expensive to do that and too much of a hassle, so they decided to try to do a colonoscopy inside the prison. I was called down and told to go into a room in which there was an ophthalmologist room. There was eyeglass equipment, and there was a bed. There was a table that you would lie down on that just had a brown plastic sheet over it that people used. And the doctor was the son of the original person that had done the colonoscopy 5 years earlier. And he was with a nurse, and they both looked at each other, looked at me. None of us felt particularly comfortable. It was freezing in there. And I asked to have at least a sheet to put over the table for some sterility and a blanket because I was so cold. And they finally brought those things. The colonoscopy proceeded. It was quite painful. They added a little bit more of, I asked for some more anesthesia. A sedative, they put a little bit more in, and after it was over, we all looked at each other and just knew that it had been a pretty bad experience. 5 years later, when I turned 60, I was ordered to have another colonoscopy, which I wanted to have, and it kept being delayed. I knew that I wasn't going to go through the same experience again, and it turned out that the delay was because the doctor refused to come in. He refused to come in and do that colonoscopy under those conditions. All right? This is an example of someone who made a decision that where the divided loyalty was, that he was going to be loyal to the medical care ethics of providing safe care. A story that took place at Danbury Correctional Facility for Women was that there was a woman at Danbury who was in a post-traumatic stress syndrome support group, therapeutic group, and she was being pat-frisked by the officers, by men. And so when a lawsuit was brought on her behalf, based on the reactions that she had, the lawyers deposed the psychiatrist that was in charge of all the psychiatric treatment. And when asked whether or not he felt that being pat-frisked by a man could create a post-traumatic stress syndrome reaction, he answered, "I am divided. I am in conflict. She is my patient, but I am an employee of the Federal Bureau of Prisons." Now, I think that I've given two examples of two different individuals, one of whom made a choice to not carry something out, another of whom allowed something to happen that wasn't under medical care per se, but affected the medical care of this patient. I think that the power to disagree, other than when you're in a context in which Home of Ventures is described, in which the actual administration is trying to take this issue on of the divided loyalty, there's thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of medical personnel, whether they're doctors, whether they're nurses, who are in a situation where they feel torn about how they're going to, on the one hand, maintain the job, and on the other hand, maintain a values around their medical work. I think that the Where do you start if you're in that situation as an individual, with an individual situation? One place you can start is by looking to see whether or not the administration in your facility may be an administration that may be, it's unusual, but it could be, that you have a superintendent or a warden who actually is more sympathetic to providing good medical care and may override a security decision that was made by a lower level of security. It is conceivable. I was in a situation in which sometimes the superintendent took that kind of care, and in fact would say occasionally, it's good that we have medical lawsuits here. She would say it on the side, anecdotally, because I could never get done what we needed to do because of the demands on me. And it's good to know about somebody like that. I think there's another kind of situation that people find themselves in who are medical personnel, and I think it's perhaps best visualized if you, many of you may know this photo, which is I think a famous photo by now. It was probably used in the Supreme Court brief, Brown v. Plata, which was the California decision in 2011, which the Supreme Court made. But it's a picture of men in cages, five men in five cages, and they are in their orange jumpsuits in California. They're standing up, and there's a man sitting on a chair, leaning over and talking to them. And he's providing group therapy to men that are in cages. Now, he faces a situation in which he's in a system that is clearly cruel and destructive, and there's sort of a, I have to say, it's a pretense of a system caring for people that actually placing them in cages does not represent that. That man has a choice. Does he work as a therapist in a system which is systematically cruel? Or does he decide not to have that job? Or does he decide to have that job because he feels he can do a better job in that job than somebody else, and at least they're going to be meeting somebody who is sympathetic to them even though they're in cages? Right? This is another kind of dilemma that people may find themselves in. So the question is of dual loyalties, the question is of what options are there for people when you're alone in a situation? And I think that when you're alone, completely alone, you may have to make a choice about what to do and how to do it. But it's not going to really work to the best that it can unless you can think larger than the system, larger than the prison itself, because there's a larger context that the prison sits in. The prison sits in a historical moment, which I think at this moment is a moment when people are much more conscious about the damage that's being done by mass incarceration. It sits in a moment in which there's social movements around prisoners' rights and healthcare as related to that is more evident. It's in a moment when professional organizations, medical professional organizations, are being involved in issues of rights of healthcare in prison, and when there's the potential for lawyers' organizations also playing a role. So I want to look at a very specific example. How am I on time? 5 minutes? Yeah. So I want to look at a very specific example in which we can see all of these things played out. Many of you may be aware of the fact that women are shackled during their trips to the hospital. They're shackled during their labor, and they're shackled during their delivery in 33 states out of the country. Only 18 states have laws that provide that prevent shackling, prohibit shackling. 8 more have policies. However, even if these states have policies or laws, they are, in spite of it, they're frequently ignored. In Illinois recently, there was a class action lawsuit filed by 80 female inmates claiming that they were shackled while giving birth as well as recovering. It's clear to medical personnel, I think, for the most part, that while they're giving anesthesia, while they're delivering babies, that the security risks that are maintained as major by corrections throughout the country are not actual security risks. And so what do you do about that situation? I think after years of work by civil rights, public health, women's and prisoners' advocacy groups, concerns about shackling across the country is now making a difference. In 2008, not that long ago, the Federal Bureau of Prisons banned belly shackles and the routine use of all other restraints during labor and delivery. However, restraints are still standard equipment in most states' prisons and jails. In New York State, it took editorial in the New York Times, women's groups, feminist groups, finally getting a law passed under Governor Patterson that there would be a ban to shackling people during their trips back and forth from the prison and during delivery. But I think that the lesson in this is that over the last 3 or 4 years, as a result of the consciousness that's been raised by women's movement, by public health advocates, by health people themselves, there are now professional organizations, whether it's public health organizations, whether it's AMA, whether it's organizations of gynecological and obstetricians. These organizations have taken positions that this is a violation of healthcare to shackle a woman when she's delivering and when she's giving birth, when she's in labor. And I think what I'm trying to raise is that the individual medical person who's facing a conflict, a dual loyalty role inside of a prison, to the degree that they can lift themselves out of the context and imagine that there's other people doing things and that they may be able to provide a role, they may be able to give testimony, they may be able to give information even if they want to remain anonymous, that there's a role that can be played if they see the larger context. Because in the end, it's the larger context that's actually going to be able to make change inside. Thank you.